Welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard with the stories behind history's greatest rock bands.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
three.
Today in the studio, it's the first of a two-part visit with the Grateful Dead, calling it a career and bidding us fare thee well after 50 years.
Driving that train, high on cocaine, Casey Jones, you better watch your speed.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in, keep trucking. Like the Doodah Man,
they're a band beyond description.
Roll away.
Well, actually, they were going to hang it up, and I remember that it was in 74. I'd come down to Winterland, and we played together again, and it was really a turn-on.
California, preaching on the burning shore.
I think we've always kicked that around for years.
We'd always been kicking the idea around to play at special places, places of power.
And then one night, Phil and I went to Bill's house, Graham's house, yeah. And we had placards and a flashlight that said, bigger PA, and the other side is Egypt or bust.
I need a miracle every day.
Hey, this is Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead in the studio.
I'm Bobby Weir with the Grateful Dead.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead.
For so many of the key individuals in the San Francisco music scene of the mid-60s, the Bay Area was a promise of hope, a destination, not home. Carlos Santana and his family had emigrated from Tijuana, Mexico. Janis Joplin from the Texas oil refineries in Beaumont. Steve Miller from Dallas via Chicago. Even rock concert impresario and Grateful Dead manager Bill Graham was imported from Berlin, Germany to San Francisco via New York City. But not Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. Garcia was born and raised in San Francisco, and he could trace one side of his family tree back a full six generations there. Since 1965, when they were known as the Warlocks, the Grateful Dead wrote their own colorful history in American rock culture. In a span of 50 years, the Grateful Dead amassed a legion of fans, affectionately known as Deadheads, who are themselves legendary for loyal fanaticism that's simply unparalleled in rock and roll. Over this period, the Dead's concert, tour merchandise, and album revenues grew to the level of a Fortune 500 corporation. Yet it certainly didn't start out that way. According to Grateful Dead singer-guitarist Bob Weir, Dead drummer Mickey Hart, and bass player Phil Lesh, preparing to celebrate 50 years of the long, strange trip down the Golden Road with Fare Thee Well final performances in Santa Clara, California, beginning June 27 and wrapping up July 5 in Chicago. In 1965, could they have dared to imagine the current intense desire to see and hear the Grateful Dead a full 15 years deep into the 21st century? Here's Bob Weir, Phil Lesh, and Mickey Hart with me in the studio.
I mean, you know, when the music stops, there's always the mythology, you know, or the stories and all that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, I mean, who knows how long it would go on, you know. We'll know in 100 years if it's a footnote. Or if it's really part of the fabric of culture. That's how you know. History will tell the story.
We weren't thinking. We were trying to make it from note to note. We were trying to make it from note to note. And that's all we've ever done. That's pretty much all we're going to continue to do.
We got so we could fake it pretty well.
And making long-term plans and career moves and stuff like that has not been our forte, as it's easily enough seen. We're just making it from day to day, from note to note.
The Grateful Dead were actually a free-spirited, self-described experimental band, releasing albums before any similarly adventuresome radio stations existed to play them in North America until around 1970, when the Grateful Dead's Working Man's Dead album provided a counterculture sing-along, Casey Jones. Ranking the album at number 262 all-time, Rolling Stone magazine gave Working Man's Dead exceedingly high praise as, I quote, stripped-down country and folk tunes that rival the best of Bob Dylan, end quote. Still, Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh were highly impressed with a series of Jamaican bands who'd play the burgeoning San Francisco music clubs like The Matrix, The Angry Dog, and Bill Graham's Fillmore West and Winterland. Here's Bob Weir of The Grateful Dead.
The Heptones. I love the Heptones. The guys who did Book of Rules. And also, everybody loved Marley.
Oh, Toots?
Yeah, Toots.
Yeah, but Marley was the biggest voice, really, because he would actually come to town.
Yeah, we saw him live here.
Yeah, I saw him at the Paramount in Oakland.
Yeah, and he tore the place up. No, they were a pretty close scene, you know. I mean, they were real tight when they came to town. They came in, they had their own music. It wasn't like a jam band. They were here for serious business. Right. And they would testify.
And
it was church. I mean, you looked up on the stage and you couldn't see him. He was covered with smoke. I mean, you looked up and all you could see on the stage was just smoke around his head. You know, I mean, these guys, it was serious. It was religion, you know.
Barely 6 months after Working Man's Dead, fans were forever grateful to receive the collection of songs titled American Beauty, containing Sugar Magnolia. In effect, the Grateful Dead had made their White Album, their Electric Ladyland, except that the Disc 1 was available half a year before Disc 2. This level of quality and prolific quantity began to attract some speculators on the business side, as the Dead's major label record contract was set to renew or expire, and a suitor began whispering in the young band's collective ear.
We had a guy who came our way who was a real good salesman, and he pretty much gained our confidence and talked us into believing that we could be businessmen as well as musicians. And within a few months, we were all carrying briefcases and
come on, Bob, you never carried a briefcase?
Yeah, I did.
When?
I started carrying a real briefcase, the real thing. It was leather and everything.
Well, he certainly doesn't anymore, folks.
Yeah, but what was inside of it?
Papers and stuff.
Oh, that's the worst kind.
You know, we were selling our records, but we found that we had no business in that business. We didn't have the leverage that it takes to be a record company. If you're a record company, basically people don't pay you for the last record you sold until you come up with a new one. And we make records, you know, when we're really punching them out at a good clip every couple, 3 years. And it was impossible for us to get paid for the records we made. And so then we tried to hook up with, was it MGM Records? Artie Mogul. Who was he with?
Universal.
Universal, that's Universal. Right. It seemed to most of us that we were sort of in league with a bunch of gangsters at that point.
Would this new siren song encouraging total independence come from a friendly ally or a friend of the devil? Find out from Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh coming up next. In celebration of their 50th anniversary, all of these wonderful songs are included on the new double CD, The Best of the Grateful Dead, a tasty, career-spanning collection of really fine-sounding studio recordings, available now at Amazon.com. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh, saying, fare thee well on the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead.
Hey, this is Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead in the studio.
I'm Bobby. We're with the Grateful Dead.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead. Here's Redbeard.
Thanks, guys. In the early 70s, rock had matured to a point where its biggest selling bands could negotiate a buffer between their record companies and themselves by incorporating as their own record company. The Beatles had pioneered it with the Apple label. The Rolling Stones did so in 1971, and Led Zeppelin followed by 1974. Businessman Ron Rackow convinced the Dead to form Grateful Dead Records, so I wondered what challenges the band faced in actually running it on a daily basis. First, Phil Lesh, then Mickey Hart, and finally Bob Weir in the studio.
We didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
Rackow was pretty well taking the head of it, you know, doing what he wanted, and we just wanted to play music and not get our instruments repossessed.
Our product, you know.
We were always in financial jam, and Rackow promised us, you know, freedom. You know, he said, "You just play, and we'll have record companies, and we'll be able to go on and do all this kind of thing. We'll do it our way, but." Our way wasn't our way, it was his way, because we had no idea. So he got us into trouble and into debt, and it wasn't illegal or anything like that, but it was borrowing on a future that no one knew about. It just wasn't sound business.
No, not at all. We the biggest challenges for us were, as well as being musicians, we had to become either businessmen or crooks or both. And we weren't cut from that cloth.
In naming the album American Beauty at number 255 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time, the editors claim, and I quote, "The Dead were never better in the studio than on the down-home stoner country of American Beauty," end quote. Yet less than 5 years later, the pressure of running a business resulted in Mickey Hart leaving the Grateful Dead. Jerry Garcia's pet project movie was shelved and a Live Dead album stiffed. Mickey Hart reveals that the Grateful Dead came this close to breaking up for good.
Well, actually, they were going to hang it up, and I remember that it was in 74, and I'd come down to Winterland, and we played together again, and it was really a turn-on. And then I started hanging out at Weir's house when we were doing Blues for Allah, and that thing started working really well, so there was no reason why not to. You know, it just started, we had the chemistry again, and I had done what I had to do. I made my recording studio, built it, learned about engineering, and made a solo record in that time, and that was it.
I was glad it was
My disappointment was that my record was the last of the round records. It was the last one to go down there where all the other ones are, you know, at the bottom of the ocean, where Davy Jones lives. Well, Rackow sealed its fate, you know, and I did a thing called the Digger Rhythm Band record, okay, and this was the last of the too. Great round records, and you know, it was something I had worked on for years and years. It was a very special thing. So it was the end of it. You know, by that time, everything was falling apart. They didn't Rackow's connections were turning against us. And, you know, it was the record company wasn't the record company. They were the enemy.
Unbroken Chain, a gorgeous song with bass player Phil Lesh on lead vocal from the 1973 Mars Hotel album. Somehow, the circle remained unbroken for the band members. But Bob Weir and Mickey Hart assured us that nevertheless, there was collateral damage from the experience.
I think the one of us who was the most disappointed was Billy Kreitzman, insofar as he didn't get to tar and feather, disembowel, and draw and quarter on Rackow before Rackow got out of town. And then on top of that, Rackow got out of town with a lot of our money.
Oh, yeah, he wrote himself a check. There was that. Yeah, he thought he was his severance pay. I think he wrote himself $250,000 severance pay.
I quit, and I'm taking everything with me.
Yeah, I earned it. You guys will make some more someday. It's okay. It won't hurt you too bad. I'll see you later. Goodbye. It was one of those kind of nice things.
Still to come, the Grateful Dead decide to play the Blues for Allah in the Cradle of Civilization. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh for the 50th anniversary with the best of the Grateful Dead.
Hey, this is Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead in the studio, part one.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Phil Lesh of the Grateful Dead. Here's Redbeard.
Thanks again, guys. After original Grateful Dead keyboard player Ron Pigpen McKernan died from an alcohol-related stomach hemorrhage in 1973, Keith Godshaw replaced him, bringing a new dynamic into the laid-back band, according to Mickey Hart and Bob Weir.
A number of things.
He had a wife in the band, and that wasn't really, that was a problem, you know, because sometimes it may be able to work, but when you're working that closely with your spouse, you know, and you're in the same rock and roll band, there's a million kind of rubs that go on, because then when they got into a fight, it brought us into it with them. You know, we were like bystanders.
They used to try to get us to take sides. Hey, listen, this is not my fight. Oh, yes, it is.
So the music became secondary to the soap opera that was going on, you know, and that's where
it got pretty hairy. I mean, I remember one time leaving, I was just about to leave a recording session that we were having, and I heard a bunch of crashing going on in the parking lot out in front, and they were in their cars, both of them had BMWs, and they were just running into each other, you know, backing up and running into each other again.
Oh yeah, one of them was kicking the limo drivers or something, because the bags were, oh god, it was endless. So their rub became our rub, and that was a bad thing.
From the Grateful Dead's 1975 classic album Blues for Allah, the music never stopped. By 1977, the Grateful Dead had signed to the relatively new Arista Records label founded by veteran music executive Clive Davis. Clive wanted some changes before he did the deal. Bob Weir, Phil Lesh, and Mickey Hart remember having to call on Lowell George from Little Feet.
Well, he wanted us to use a competent producer. We'd been producing ourselves up to that point. And he also wanted us to use commercial songwriters and commercial tunes every now and again. Well, we never went for that. We did use the quote commercial producers, end quote.
Yeah, Lowell.
Yeah, that's. I wouldn't call Lowell exactly a professional producer. He was the only one who raised his hand. The poor bastard. God save him, wherever he is.
Yeah, I think we had to drag Gary Lyons in, kicking and screaming.
Yeah, that's another one. I wouldn't call him a professional producer either.
What did he do before you?
He was a plumber. He was a plumber. Nothing wrong with plumbers.
No. He produced somebody else.
He was a plumber, man. We were his first job.
No, not
just kidding.
Not so. He had a lot of chart success with bands like Foreigner, and
yeah.
He's doing metal bands in Germany now and stuff like that.
He's the only one I know that listened to when he monitored back at full volume, as loud as a speaker could go. He's famous for that, actually. He had our poor little babies just squeaking.
It's from 1977's Grateful Dead album, Terrapin Station, Estimated Profit. It's profit spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, a clever pun from the Grateful Dead's days at running their own record label. For the deadhead who thinks he or she has everything, now there's an ornate 80-disc box set and USB drive containing 30 unreleased Grateful Dead concerts spanning the band's entire career. It's available for pre-order now, exclusively at dead.net. Bob Weir, Mickey Hart, and Phil Lesh return next week at this same day and time for part two of The Best of the Grateful Dead. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Mickey Hart, Phil Lesh, and Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead. They'll all return next week, same day and time. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song, Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.